Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. 3 minutes after 9 a.m., March 16, 2023. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Co-Chair Senator Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Giesels joined us in the peanut gallery. This morning, we're going to have two presentations. We're going to try to have two presentations. We have quite a few slides. So we're going to start first with Mr. Dan Robinson. He's the research chief for the Department of Labor. And then when he's done, we're going to go to Brett Watson from the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. So we're going to try to get through these the best we can. We'll see how it goes. So with that, Mr. Robinson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and take us through your presentation, and we'll have questions at the end of each slide, or what slides we have questions on. But take it away, please.
Good morning. I'm Dan Robinson, Research Chief at the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Research and Analysis Section. I looked at Brett Watson's slides, and for some of the first few, I'll go a little faster than I otherwise would have. I didn't know that Brett was going to be here until I saw last night, so maybe that'll help a little bit. But jumping right in, broadly, just before I start anything, numbers quite often need context. Economic data more than other numbers. When you talk billions, millions, it's hard to know whether that's a big number or a small number. Okay, so the idea today was to give you the context both of our historical performance by these big economic measures, and then also to look a little bit at the other states to see how we're doing relative to those. So those are the two pieces of context I want to give when I show you these numbers today. We'll start with gross domestic product. So that's the value of the goods and services that are produced in Alaska. That doesn't mean this money stays in Alaska. Oil prices go up, our GDP goes up, shareholders make money. That doesn't necessarily mean that Alaska's economy, by one measure, it does mean Alaska's economy grew. But just keep in mind the what's produced here doesn't necessarily stay here. So looking at this data set and generally we're going to talk about our oil era economy. All the slides I'm going to show you are from the 70s forward, and then some of them focusing on the last decade. So what you see here, I won't linger here, but broadly you see how much less volatile the U.S. GDP number is. You see in the 70s and 80s, we're way above U.S. GDP growth. We're really booming. But then another thing that you'll see a little bit on another slide is in the 2000s, we had some of that volatility. It looked like in the 90s, like that volatility was mostly behind us. But then we had a wild ride in the 2000s, oil prices. Smoothing that a little bit, this is just averaging the previous five, the year shown plus the four previous. So it's a 5 year trailing average. And a couple of things I wanted to point out here is the U.S. economy by this 5 year average measure never drops below zero. U.S. economy over this whole four decades, roughly, always averages in the positive. That's not true for Alaska. We see in the late 90s, we average for several years in a row less. We have GDP loss. We have a brief period, late 90s, and then focus probably more than anything on the 2014 and forward. We have been below, we have not had GDP growth on that five-year average metric for quite a while now. So this is just a reminder. This is from an article that Neil Fried, a longtime economist in our shop, wrote 10 years ago. By economic measures, oil is the unchallenged king in terms of what it's produced economically for Alaska. This quote from Terrence Cole, longtime UAF Alaska historian, puts it very succinctly. You add up all the other stuff, it doesn't come close. It's important. It's interesting. It's culturally, you know, but by economic measures, oil has dominated Alaska's economy for decades. And this highlights that a little bit too. This is looking at Alaska's GDP as a percentage of total compared to the U.S. And there are three kind of areas of this graph I want to highlight. First, on the left side, you see five things that we have proportionately more of than the U.S. economy. So the first one is essentially oil. Mining is in there too, but mining is very small compared to oil by this measure. And this is 2021 data. The second bar, transportation and warehousing, that's also mostly oil. Pipeline transportation is the bulk of that. And that's way more stable than the mining, quarrying piece, because you're familiar with this, the pipeline, the way it makes money is far more consistent than oil extraction, especially production. Then we have state and local government. We have proportionately more of that than the U.S. overall. And then the last two are really important, military and federal civilian. They're bigger, they're more important in Alaska by this GDP measure than they are in other states. So that's point one. Point two, the next four things, they're kind of the things that are everywhere. And we're about the same size by those measures. Healthcare, construction, restaurants and hotels. We have a big tourism sector, but that doesn't, it doesn't show up here as bigger in our economy than the U.S. economy broadly. And then the far right, the four bars, these are things we have proportionately much less of. Manufacturing being one of the obvious ones. Our manufacturing is mostly seafood processing. That food manufacturing component, we do a lot of that. We're world class in seafood and in seafood processing, but it doesn't add up to nearly as big of a piece of our economy as the U.S. Some of the reasons are obvious. We're kind of off in a corner the way you, in terms of where the markets are, transportation costs. We're a big state. But then the other two, the next two, are kind of these white-collar jobs. We have those. We have people who work for Exxon in Anchorage. But we don't. What we do have here is mostly to serve our in-state population. We're not Connecticut. We're not Delaware. We're not Northern California. We don't have a lot of those high-dollar white-collar jobs that serve states, that serve a population outside their state. Not nearly. The kind that the U.S. has. And then the last one, all other, it's obviously a hodgepodge. One thing, farming is one thing that shows up there. We don't have a lot of farming wealth here. Linger here, I won't. This first measure of how we're doing by this GDP metric in our current decade is the closest we could come to it, the 2022 annual data aren't out yet, but you see this decade roughly has been the lowest performing by this measure of the last five. And we'll leave it at that for this. So now moving to the comparison with other states, you can see over that almost decade here, Alaska has minus 8% our GDP percentage. You see the five highest performing states by this measure. And you'll see some of these states show up several times in my presentation. And then you see the states that are struggling by this measure. And one thing you see they have in common is oil and in some cases coal. Wyoming and West Virginia, coal is big. But Alaska, Louisiana, North Dakota, it's been a rough decade for the oil industry. And that's the bulk of what we see here. But it hasn't been a harder decade for the oil industry in Alaska than it has in Louisiana or North Dakota. And there's something I want to come back to about that. What sets us apart a little bit from those states?
Go ahead and finish your slide, please.
That's all I have for this slide.
Senator Bishop.
Dan, I'd just like to make a comment on Idaho and Washington. The two states, depending upon where you live, have electrical rates between 5.5 and 6 cents a kilowatt. You know, so they can attract a lot of these other manufacturing businesses, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Next slide, please.
So, and Senator Bishop, through the chair, I looked a little bit, I was curious, and we have been for 6 or 7 years, to the extent we've been making these types of comparisons, what's going right in some of those states, which is an interesting and important question. And energy costs, there are a lot of things, and it would be hard to quantify specifically, but that's an interesting one, I agree. So shifting to employment now, what we, the Department of Labor, are more familiar with probably than anything, maybe demographics would be in that same category. You can see over the history of our oil era, you can see the 70s, strong growth as we built the pipeline. You can see strong economic, strong employment growth in the early 80s, our 80s recession. And then you see, if you go to the far right, that we peak at 339,000 jobs. These are wage and salary jobs. So this doesn't include self-employment. It doesn't include the military. But it's by far the biggest proportion of the people in Alaska working. And so you see the COVID dip. These are annual averages. So if you looked at the monthly data, that drop would be bigger. And you can see our bounce back, and we're still 22,000 roughly below what we were in 2015. Notice also that after that peak, we had 2015 through 2018, what we called at the time a state-level recession. As Brett Watson will tell you, there's no accepted definition for a state-level recession, but broadly economic downturn and oil, again, the initial problem there. So this now, looking at the previous four decades again, you can see once again this decade, we've underperformed relative to the previous four. It's been our toughest decade in that era. And now looking at the other state, the same measure, the top five and the bottom five states, you see, like I mentioned before, some familiar states. This is by employment growth, remember. And you see overall the U.S. grew 12%. By this measure, Alaska's down 5%, 50th among states. We see, again, North Dakota, Louisiana. You see Wyoming, which wasn't on the other, West Virginia, again. Hawaii's kind of interesting, and I'll show you something in a minute that'll kind of explain Hawaii. So this is looking in a little more detail at the high-performing states and Alaska over that decade, over the last 10 years. And you see going into a couple things. First, you see that 2015 to 2018 job loss period that I mentioned. And you see the other all five other states are performing quite strongly pre-COVID. Then you see the COVID plunge. And other than us, Nevada is the only state that fell as hard. Cruise ships are kind of the short answer to why that was. Nevada had big shutdown of gaming industry. And then you see that those states are already post-COVID performing better than Alaska. So kind of the health, and we wrote about this once, the health of your economy going into COVID would have a lot to do with the health of your economy coming out of COVID. There'd be an obvious bounce from the industries that were shut down or had to shut down, but then you'd be back to roughly where you were before.
Okay. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the department done any studies in terms of workforce on how these states sort of recuperated their workforce? I mean, some states, it seems, in some industries, they just haven't had the return back to industries that are just normally just healthy industries across many multiple platforms. You know, I think the average is 1-2 jobs for every one applicant going on now, and that's nationwide. So how did these states sort of recover those growths in the same similar industries that we have? That we still can't seem to fill.
Yeah, Senator Wilson, through the chair, the best data set for that is probably job openings, and we do look at that by state. What all of these states, I'm looking to make sure this is true, have that Alaska doesn't, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more, is positive migration. Several of them, Utah in particular, has a younger age structure, so they've got more young people aging into the workforce. All of these states have baby boomers aging out of the workforce. If you've got a young population, and again, Utah does, then you've got more people proportionally aging into the population. But all of these states are attracting more people to their states than are moving away from their states. That's one answer. That's probably the best answer, which doesn't mean they're not also struggling to fill open positions. All of the states have unusually high job openings rates. Some of that is age structure issue. Some of that is most of that is age structure. Don't believe, and I think this has been debunked well enough, this people don't want to work anymore. That was never the problem. That was understandable for people to wonder about that. If, you know, high unemployment insurance benefits or some of those things, you heard that a little bit, that for some reason people's appetite to work has disappeared. That was never true. It's a math problem, partly. Fewer people of working age. And then it's also, it kind of spirals. When there are openings everywhere, people bump up. And so the industry that's struggling more than any nationwide is leisure and hospitality. The lower wage jobs that you know, you don't need a lot of education or training to get. Those people are finding more opportunities. But that's true a little bit all the way up the chain. If you're a job seeker right now, it's a golden time to be looking for a job. So all of these states are struggling to a degree. We're struggling more because we're losing some of our people, and in particular of working age.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, I wish I would have thought to have you brought a slide to show population by age group, starting with the boomers and going right on up to right now, because our problem is the birth rates. If you're going to grow your own workforce.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, birth rates have been declining for a long time, and they declined a little more during COVID. Death rates have been increasing a little bit, and I shouldn't say that. I need to make sure that's true. But death rates took a noticeable uptick, including in the working ages during COVID. So, and those aren't big numbers, but that's. I'm glad you pointed that out. This was always going to be a challenge when the baby boomers aged out. They're just a very large population cohort, and the population coming behind them is smaller. So this was, without COVID, without anything else that's happened, it was going to be a good time for job seekers just because of the numbers. But then these other things kind of made that far more poignant, far more pointed. So this is a comparison to, this is us and the other five states that are at the low growth end by jobs. And a couple things I wanted to point out here. One, kind of just interestingly, Hawaii shut down harder than anybody, and you see that in their COVID plunge. Another thing, and more relevant, is that notice that North Dakota in 2016 and 15, and Wyoming, if you squint, you can see, and Louisiana, Wyoming, all had kind of a rough few years, 16, 17, 18. Oil prices fell, but they bounced back faster than Alaska. And I'm gonna come back to this as to the why. Another thing, North Dakota, look how strong they were performing earlier than that. They got more of a boom from shale, obviously, than we did. And they're struggling a little bit now. But all the oil and natural resources, especially oil, coal too, are struggling. Those states are struggling a little bit. You see Hawaii's growing quite strongly. So Hawaii's probably an outlier in this group. The others, they depend on oil and like I said, secondarily coal. So in here we look at population change, and this is overall population change. And what you see here, again, some familiar states, and Senator Wilson, to your point, you see these states are growing. So if your population is growing, you've just got more bodies to fill open positions. Alaska is 46th by this measure. But if you look at our working age population, we just wrote an article for the March issue of Trends, where we looked specifically at the working age population. Our working age population over this period has declined by about 30,000. We go from 479,000 to 449,000, which is a little bit more than a 6% decline. So, and obviously, I just for quickly mention, people don't have to stop work. Working age doesn't mean people have to stop working. And one of the solutions that probably smart employers will think about is how do we keep some of those older workers around, because you don't have to stop work, unless you're a pilot or a Supreme Court justice in Alaska, some other places.
Senator Wilson and Senator Keel.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson, do you know why sort of Idaho? Because I don't think of Idaho as a very attractive place. So what are they doing differently than here in Alaska, or I mean any of these states, Utah, you know, Nevada, I mean Texas and Florida may have different you know, in migration from other areas, but just wondering, are they doing something different that we should take a look at?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, the broad answer for both of those states, and I need to take this for, I'm not an expert on those states' economies, but demographically, we've wondered some of those same questions, asked and dug around to see what we can find. One of the things both of those states have is good tech sectors, and they've got some low wage kind of advantages over Northern California, for example. Another thing they have is lifestyle attractiveness. And you'll see the Mountain West states, in particular, Colorado shows up in some of these data sets. People want to live there for different reasons, the combination of what they offer, maybe some move away from East Coast cities. But another important thing they both have is far cheaper housing than California. So California has really expensive housing. If you want to move from California and stay in the West, Idaho and Utah, and, you know, you say it's not attractive, Yellowstone, Park City, there are places in both of those cities that I think kind of everybody would agree are pretty attractive. And that's true of Montana. Nevada is interesting. You know, it's a desert, but there are parts of Nevada that attract people. And that other Nevada, Florida, Texas, part of that is warm weather. And we'll see that in some other places. Old Northeast baby boomers, where do they like to go? They want to go somewhere warmer. So you see Florida for that reason. You see Arizona and Nevada would be a little bit in that category.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for being here. Appreciate the presentation. What's the difference here in population change from four slides ago, slide 10, that change in employment? And the reason I ask is, on the big gainers in both, you have almost exactly the same states. The only difference is you switch Texas for Arizona. But on the losers, for population change, Hawaii, Wyoming, North Dakota drop off, Mississippi, Illinois pop up. What's the difference in which is driving what?
Yeah, Senator Keel, that's a good question. It would be a fairly complicated answer. Some of it is age structure. Mississippi has been struggling by a lot of economic measures for a long time. So there have been people leaving Mississippi. That's true of West Virginia even more so. One question that I have quite often trying to answer that question is, to what degree non-resident workers are part of that? In Alaska, we have about 20% of our workforce are non-residents. So they would show up in the employment data set, but not in the population data set. Other states can't measure their non-resident employment as well as we can because we have the PFD data set. So we know who's a resident of Alaska. So that's part of it. I think age structure would be a fairly big part of it as well. But that's a half answer.
Senator Merrigan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here. This is very interesting. My question is, do you think tax structure, the state's tax structure, has anything to do with this in-out migration?
Yeah, Senator Merrigan, it's an interesting question. I think the data would show that taxes are a very minor factor. It's worth thinking about, especially with the baby boomers, because you want to go somewhere where you maximize, you know, on a fixed income. And on that measure, Texas, Nevada, Florida would all have some. All five of those states would be relatively low. Nevada benefits from gaming, so they have, you know, the kinds of taxes a retiree would think about. There would be some advantages in all five of those states.
Can I follow up?
Yes, quickly.
Okay. Now I lost my train of thought. Never mind. Sorry.
I've got a quick question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I know.
When you talk about taxes, are you talking about not just the absence of income tax here, but also real estate taxes in some of the bigger cities?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Olson, probably more than anything, income taxes. The other stuff doesn't add up to very much. Property taxes would be interesting too. That's a local feature.
Next slide, please.
So just this is population. This is the article I mentioned, working age population. This is another article in that issue, talks about our 2022 population estimates. And you've heard probably about this stretch of negative net migration. And this, the reason I put this slide in here is so you could see the how much that's driven by out-migration, people leaving the state, and how much that's driven by people in not coming to the state. And it was more people stopped coming to the state to the same magnitude as they, more so than out-migration stays high. But it's not like we had a big increase in out-migration. We had proportionally a bigger decrease in in-migration. And this is kind of quantifying that. These are the 10 years. This is the net number. For those 10 years, that adds up to a little more than 53,000 more people have left Alaska than moved here. That doesn't mean our population declined by 53,000. Underneath this, there's births and deaths, and our population was actually down only about 2,000 over that period. So don't confuse those two. And then this is in that article about our working age population. This shows first the blue line, our long-term trends by age group. Who do we attract? Historically, we attract people in their early, in their late 20s through their late 30s. Alaska has had historically a lot to attract people. Some of that's military too, but it's a big, exciting place. It's a place of promise. It's a high wage place historically. And you see that in the age structure. And notice too that when you attract 30-year-olds and people in their late 20s, you see the blue lines to the far left of the graph. You have growth in your children, younger ages. The 15 to 19, we've always been a net exporter of college-age kids. More of our college kids have always left Alaska than stayed, than we've attracted to Alaska. That would be very different than Massachusetts and North Carolina, some other states. They're net importers of college-age kids. And then Alaska's a colder place, so when you get to the older ages, the blue lines, notice they're negative starting 40s, but even more. When people get to retirement ages, we've always lost more than we've gained. People don't retire from cold weather state to cold weather state. They generally go to warm weather places. But then the yellow lines, the thing I'll point out is every age group is negative with the exception of that 25 to 29 group. And some of that's military. We've had a good stretch of military, Eielson, F-35s. And just to quickly make sure this graph is clear, what this is the average number per year. So 25 to 29-year-olds from 1990 to 2013, we were importing about 1,000 people in that age group per year. That does a lot to fill open positions. And that number is still positive, like I said, but it's in the 300s now. And then just trying to wrap this up, kind of broad strokes, we wrote this article back in 2017, I think, about we looked at all states' recessions, downturns. The question was whether we were in a recession at the time. But the thing I wanted to point out here is that, and this goes away, goes partway to explaining why our recession lasted a little longer from 15 to 18. When oil prices fell, this we say here, that initial shock, we lost 6,000 oil and gas jobs, almost $200,000 per job. That's over $1 billion just in wages. That's the first shock. And we didn't know at the time, and we still don't know, kind of the long-term future of oil and gas in Alaska. But the secondary shock that we were referencing here is this budget situation, the thing you've been struggling with for a while. We say created the near certainty that Alaska was going to have to do something to move off this long period where oil was enough to pay all of our bills. It was, and we built a $75 billion permanent fund. And you know, but it looked like at this time, and there have been other times in Alaska since the early 2000s, when it looked like that era was coming to an end. But that's what we were referring to back in 2017. Second point related to that, so we bump ahead a little bit, the POMV method was put into place. That very large change creates $3.5 billion in perpetuity. That's a huge step towards moving into that era where it's not all oil that pays our bills. At the time, it wasn't enough. We needed a billion plus more. It looks, and we talk of that last paragraph there, all of the choices have pros and cons. So, you know, the dividend, obviously. revenue, which taxes, some kind of general tax, a cut in state government. Those things are kind of structural changes that will have economic costs, all of them. None of them are free. There's no solution that's easy, or we wouldn't be here kind of talking about some of this stuff. But we're I think, going through a type of structural change along the lines of, in that article, the previous article about states' recessions lingering. We talked about manufacturing in Michigan. They lose 900,000 manufacturing jobs over a decade. We talked about Oregon timber goes away in Oregon. That's a permanent change to their economy that took a while to get through. Pulp mills in Alaska, Sitka 93, Ketchikan 97, timber industry in Alaska. We go from 2,000 timber jobs to a fraction of that. This happens in economies, and it looked to us, and the reason we look at this in broad strokes is we need to do some forecasting. So to forecast accurately, we need to kind of put our finger on the things that are going well and the things that aren't. This thing is it's a cliche, but it's a headwind for us. This is a struggle Alaska's having that other states are not. And as we say there, our economy will struggle until we get to a situation where there's stability from state government. And that's, I think, the last slide I have.
Okay, thank you for coming in today. Appreciate that. We're going to now speed along to our next presenter, Brett Watson from ICER.
Hi, this is Brett.
Would you please introduce yourself for the record, and we'll work through these slides?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Brett Watson, and I'm an assistant professor at UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research.
Okay, go ahead and just let us know when you change slides, because it's a little awkward when you're on the phone when we want the slides changed, and we'll try to speed along. We're going to try to be done here in an hour, a little less than an hour and a half.
Great. Yep, not a problem. So my second slide after the title slide should say Institute of Social and Economic Research at the title. And I just wanted to start by acknowledging two ICER funders whose financial contributions help support ICER research on the Alaska economy, First National Bank and Northrim Bank. I'd also like to acknowledge two of my ICER colleagues, Dr. Mike Jones and Dr. Mary Capriva, who helped prepare this testimony this morning. However, like all research conducted at ICER, the viewpoints that are reflected in this presentation are mine, and not those of any funders, and I take responsibility for any errors in the presentation. If we go to the next slide, which should say questions about the state of Alaska's economy, I've organized this presentation into four main sections. The first section reviews a number of important aggregate economic indicators, which I believe indicate that the state is not in a recession right now, and is still continuing to recover from the short but very intense COVID pandemic recession. In the second section, I'll show you some evidence that this economic recovery that the state has experienced hasn't necessarily been uneven across the distribution of income in our economy. In the third section, we'll talk about how national economic factors, including the Federal Reserve's response to inflation, might create a headwind for Alaska's economy in the medium term. And then finally, we'll talk about some of the short, medium, and long-term health indicators of the state's key economic engines and how they show both positive and negative signs. On the next slide, I'll talk about how economists think about judging a recession. A common rule of thumb that people often talk about in defining recessions is two consecutive quarters of zero to negative economic growth, often measured as GDP. But in actuality, recessions are determined by a group of economists from the National Bureau of Economic Research's Business Cycle Baiting Committee. And they consider a number of factors holistically, some of which are listed on this slide here. And they do so on a relatively qualitative basis. And so, in other words, there's not really a formula for determining a national recession. And and likewise, there's no formal committee to determine state-level recession either. So Alaska's economists, like Dan and myself, we rely on a number of similar indicators to judge our state's economic health. And so we'll walk through a couple of those right now. On the next slide, you'll see one of the most important indicators, which is payroll employment. Dan showed you a different version of the same information in his presentation. I'm showing what are referred to as seasonally adjusted numbers here from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Alaska's economy is very seasonal. We've got much more employment in the summer than in the winter. So we can smooth out some of those fluctuations by using seasonally adjusted numbers. Just for a couple of reference points here, in 2019, sort of that the pandemic, pre-pandemic year, Alaska averaged 330,000 jobs that year. And that was true right up until the pandemic hit in about February of 2020. And then over the course of the next 2 months, the state shed around 50,000 jobs. And so we can see the state moving into that deep trough there. But soon after began to recover. The kind of the trough happened around April of 2020 in our state. As of December of 2022, the state was about 6,000 jobs short of where it was compared to pre-pandemic levels. So you can see the state's recovered pretty significantly from our COVID recession, but we're still short of that pre-pandemic level. On the next slide, we can compare Alaska to the national environment. You can see that both Alaska and the U.S. as a whole lost about 15% of total employment. On the y-axis here, we can see that movement from about 100 to 50, 85, and that's a difference of 15% employment loss. The U.S. employment is now above where it was pre-pandemic, but Alaska still lags behind. We can see that Alaska's job growth rate slowed in the middle of 2021 and has remained relatively steady since. One possible reason that Alaska isn't back up to its pre-pandemic levels is because it experienced a more severe COVID contraction than some of the other U.S. states. However, we can see in this figure that our shock was roughly proportional to the U.S. shock. And so if we go to the next slide, we can see this illustrated across U.S. states. And this was, I think, a point that Dan made to some extent. And so this slide shows the relationship between the speed of each state's recovery from the COVID recession compared to the depth of their COVID recession. So the x-axis here is how deep each state's COVID recession was, and the y-axis is how much each state has recovered. So on the far right-hand side of this figure, you can see states like Hawaii and Nevada, which, as Dan mentioned, rely heavily on tourism and shut down pretty hard during the pandemic. They've been relatively slow to recover. Nevada is actually back up to above its pre-pandemic levels. You can see that indicated as it appearing above that dotted horizontal line there. But states that are above that dotted horizontal line have larger economies today than they did before the pandemic. So we can see that there's some relationship between the depth of a state's COVID recession and its recovery since the COVID recession, but that's not the whole story. On the next slide, we can see that there's actually a much stronger relationship between how well a state was doing before the pandemic and how much it's recovered since the pandemic started. States that have recovered relatively quickly since the pandemic were growing pretty strongly before, and states that were lagging before the pandemic, their recoveries have been more slowly. And I believe that this is a point that Dan also made during his presentation. Another measure of state economic activity is gross state product, which we can see on the next slide. GDP measures the total value of goods and services that the Alaska economy produces. And here I've included measurements of GDP both in nominal and constant dollar terms, real terms being inflation adjusted. As you can see, the figure between 2012 and 2020, nominal GDP has been flat or declining. But since 2020, nominal GDP has grown fairly quickly. However, once we make that adjustment for inflation, that we can see in that purple line, we see that real GDP has actually been flat or declining since 2012, and today is lower than it was pre-pandemic. And so if we think about that gap between nominal and real GDP, virtually all of that is attributable to the effects of rising prices as opposed to changes in volumes of output. So lots of inflation. occurring here. On the next slide, we'll compare changes in Alaska's GDP to changes in the GDP for other states in the same way that we made the comparison for employment. And so the horizontal axis here is how fast each state was growing in terms of its GDP. And the vertical axis is how quickly they grew since the pandemic. Here you can see that there's a much weaker relationship than there was between employment and pre-pandemic growth. These numbers are all inflation adjusted. What you notice here, though, is that Alaska is kind of in the company of these other oil-dependent states, which I think is a point that Dan had made. So if you look at where Alaska appears on this figure, we're in the company of states like Oklahoma, West Virginia, North Dakota, and Wyoming, which are all below where they were before the pandemic in terms of their real GDP. The other states that are below where they were before the pandemic are New Mexico and Louisiana, which are on the right and the left-hand side of the figure, respectively, and then Hawaii. And we've kind of talked about some reasons for why those states might have been lagging in their respective recoveries in Dan's talk. On the next slide, titled Rural Energy States, Dan showed you a version of this figure, and it just shows you the dynamic in real gross domestic product for the selection of small rural energy-dependent states, North Dakota, Alaska, and Wyoming. They've all seen relatively similar trends in their economy since the pandemic, so they're all somewhat below where they were pre-pandemic, and growth has been pretty flat in real terms. The exception here is Montana, which has seen continued growth as it was seeing before the pandemic hit. On the next slide, to illustrate an important driver of fluctuations in our state's GDP, I've decomposed GDP in Alaska into its major components. These are all in nominal dollars. This figure shows that from 2005 to 2020, most industries in the state's economy experienced steady nominal growth, and then a COVID shock, and then a recovery to at least its pre-COVID level. On the other hand, the oil component of GDP has fluctuated pretty wildly over this period. And so when we think about the changes that are happening on our overall economy over this time period, they're almost all attributable to fluctuations in that oil component of GDP, rather than growth or contractions in other state industries. The movement in GDP across these other industries is simply just swamped by those fluctuations in the oil price. So besides employment and GDP, there are other indicators that economists will look to in thinking about whether an economy is expanding or contracting.
We could just stop
on the next slide, which is titled Other Alaska Economic Indicators. We see where Alaska stands with respect to some of these.
We could just stop there for a second.
Yeah, of course.
We're on page or slide 12. We have a question from Senator Wilson. And please just pause for a second at the end of the slide, and members may have a question or so.
Of course, yeah.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, just wondering here on the healthcare sector on the slide, you know, everything that we've been seeing, it shows that that sector has been increasing. But on your slide, it appears to be lagging. Can you explain why in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Senator Wilson, through the chair. Indeed, we have seen growth in the healthcare sector over this time period, particularly in employment. We do see, you know, continued growth in that sector here, but I don't have any specifics as to why growth, at least as measured in GDP, don't appear as exaggerated in that sector relative to some of the other sectors.
Okay.
All right.
We have any other questions on the slide? Okay. Next slide, 13.
So just thinking about some of these other economic indicators, we can see that unemployment insurance claims are at record low. Insurance employment claims are kind of an instantaneous measure of economic health. When layoffs occur, employees file for unemployment insurance, and that That process can happen fairly quickly, and those data are reported quickly, and so we can get a fairly instantaneous measure of economic health by looking at unemployment insurance claims. Again, those are at record lows today in Alaska. The unemployment level is at the lowest on record in the state, somewhere close to 4.2%. And our consumer spending is up over the same time last year, using some fairly novel data from Affinity Solutions, which measures credit card transactions. So while real GDP has been flat recently in the state, most of these other signs point to slow but steady economic growth. So given these indicators, I think another useful question to ask is, how has the COVID pandemic and its associated recovery been felt kind of evenly across different types of families? So on the next slide, we show that rates of poverty in Alaska have been relatively flat between 2019 and 2020. These are data from the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey. And this general result holds when you look at families that are right at the poverty line or twice the poverty line. Those are indicated by those different colored lines in this series.
So what does this chart tell us?
So this chart is just illustrating the point that between 2019 and 2020, poverty in Alaska remained relatively static. And so I've seen some narratives in the press that there were, you know, substantial disproportionate burdens of the COVID pandemic on certain portions of the population. And at least looking at these ACS data, there's not evidence to support that claim. We see maybe if we look at the that line at the bottom of the figure, those that are 50% of the poverty level. So these are people that are experiencing fairly extreme poverty. Between 2019 and 2021, that level rose a little bit. But these data are also measured in a fairly noisy way. The sample sizes tend to be fairly small in Alaska. And so I wouldn't want to overinterpret smaller changes that we might see in these series. But certainly we don't look to this figure and see substantial changes between 2019 and 2021. And so all that to say that it looks like those at the bottom of the income distribution have weathered the COVID pandemic relatively well, or at least there's not evidence to suggest that they were disproportionately negatively impacted by the pandemic, at least in these data.
Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I just need a hand reading this chart. Is each of those lines just the increment from the previous line, or are we aggregated? Are half of Alaskans on this chart or 18% of Alaskans on this chart?
Great question. No, so these are 18 or 20% of Alaskans are on this chart. That's the top line. So just under 18 or about 18% of Alaskans are below 200 or at or below 200% of the poverty line, which in 2021 for a household of four was about $28,000 per year.
Thanks.
Any other questions on the slide? Okay, next slide.
The next slide just expands the number of families a little bit. So a slightly broader slice of the Alaska economy. Here we're looking at families up to 500% of the poverty level at that top line, down to families that are 100% of the poverty level at the bottom line in red. And here you can see again that things have been relatively static between 2019 and 2021. Again, the point here is to illustrate that at least with the best data that we have to measure that these things, there hasn't been wild fluctuation.
So you can help me with this slide. So the 40% of the people, families in the state make over $138,000 a year. Is that how to interpret this with a family of four? Five times the 27.7% poverty rate?
For a family of four, that would be the interpretation of this slide.
That's kind of a surprising number, 40% over 140,000.
I would agree. I'll ask my colleague who prepared this slide for me to clarify, and I'd be happy to get back to your office.
Okay, that would be good. Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just wondering, from the previous slide, why does the 200-100% look a little different from this slide to the slide 14, slide 15?
Between slide 14 and slide 15, I'm making an inflation adjustment. And so so slide 15 is inflation adjusted, where slide 14 is in nominal dollars.
All right, thank you.
Okay, next slide, slide 16.
So slide 16, and this might go to answer your question, Senator Stedman, about the proportion of Alaskans making a given amount of income. Here we can see a relatively narrow portion of the population that is at or above that 120,000 mark, just about 25%, if my eyeball math is correct here. But again, the way that I'm interpreting this figure is looking between 2019 and 2021, we see a lot of stasis. There isn't wild fluctuation or wildly emerging income inequality, at least based on these best available numbers that we have.
Any questions on this slide? Okay, next slide.
One of the other things that we can do is compare our poverty metrics to the rest of the United States, which is done in the next slide. U.S. poverty levels declining while U.S. is stable is the title there. And we can see that there's a similar trend for the U.S. as a whole comparing 2019 to 2020. Although prior to 2019, poverty in the United States was falling. The U.S. was experiencing a relatively robust economy during that period. So we saw falling poverty. And as Dan mentioned, most consider that Alaska was in a recession between 2015 or 2016 and 2019. So potentially unsurprising that our poverty was flat or maybe increasing a little bit over that period of time. But again, between 2019 and 2021, thinking about how the pandemic has potentially impacted people at the lowest end of the income distribution, we haven't seen much movement there, at least in these data.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Have we seen the average wage change here in Alaska during that period of time? And is the poverty line keeping up with the quick inflationary changes that we're seeing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's a great question. And one of the things that I think would be, and actually, I don't know if Dan is still in the room, he might be able to provide an assist here. One of the things that we don't have a great sense of is the distribution of wages across the economy. Oftentimes, we can get pretty good indicators of aggregate wages or overall wages, average wages, but it's often more difficult to measure the wages for folks at different points in that income distribution. The ACS data, which I've been showing here, tends to lag a bit and is measured using survey data, which is just a little bit more precise than some of the data that the Department of Labor and Dan's shop works with. And so I don't know if Dan potentially has an answer to your question about what wage movement has looked like at the lowest end of the income distribution.
Okay. So we're doing pretty well on time, better than I anticipated when we started. So if members have follow-up questions, we can fire away, and if we start running out of time, I'll speed it back up again so we get done on time today. Okay. Next slide, please. Slide 18.
So as the title of this slide suggests, Alaskan poverty rates have been trending fairly similarly to other rural energy states. I know that in Dan's presentation, he mentioned sort of some of the similar trends that Alaska, North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming have been experiencing. Well, that's true for poverty as well, at least, again, as measured in these ACS data. On the next slide, slide 19, we can see that Alaska's poverty rate hasn't been changing much differentially for white and non-white households, at least in this time period between 2019 and 2021, trying to think about that again before and after the pandemic period. And that's true of the U.S. as a whole between 2019 and 2021. Again, you do see movement both in or for the United States in declining poverty, both for the white and non-white population, whereas as poverty in Alaska, both for white and non-white families, has been relatively flat.
Okay, next slide.
So now that we've talked about the aggregate state of Alaska's economy and how it might be affecting different types of households differently, I want to talk about a few of the potential headwinds facing the economy, including inflation and some workforce shortage issues. And I'll just pause here to mention that obviously one reason to think about inflation is how it's impacting the cost of living for families. But the other reason to keep an eye on it is because the Federal Reserve is taking actions to cool the economy and to fight inflation. And the Fed might decide that controlling inflation is worth pushing the national economy into a recession. And so obviously keeping an eye on the national inflation rate is an indication of what the future actions by the Federal Reserve might be. If inflation is running hot, the Fed might take more aggressive action to cool the economy. The thing that I think is important to note here especially is that Alaska is obviously a small state relative to the national economy, and that means that our state's needs are not a large factor in the Federal Reserve's calculation. And so even if our state is struggling and has low inflation, if the Federal Reserve sees a hot national economy, they'll still put downward pressure on it, which will in turn affect our state's economy. And so I think keeping an eye both on Alaska's inflation and the national inflation rate is important for this reason.
Okay. And then on when they look at Alaska, do they commingle Alaska with the West Coast district with California? Fed Reserve District?
Alaska does have its own inflation measure. We have the Anchorage Consumer Price Index. And so there is an Alaska-specific measure of consumer prices from the BLS. But as I note here, Alaska is just such a small part of the U.S. economy that it's unlikely to factor into the Fed's calculation in setting interest rates.
Okay, but can you help me a little bit? Do they measure the states individually, or do they measure them to the different Federal Reserve districts?
For inflation calculations, or for overall economic health?
For policy calls by the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, so they do measure, or they think about regional economies at that state or the Federal Reserve district level. That's correct, Senator Stedman.
Okay, which means we'd be linked in with California, isn't that correct?
I believe that Alaska and California are in the West Coast Federal Reserve district.
Yes, okay. Okay. Next slide, please.
So with respect to inflation, the next slide is going to show you that the consumer price index for both Alaska and the U.S. Just to get you oriented on this figure, here we've indexed to a value of 100 for February of 2020. And so that means that a value of 100 are going to indicate that prices are the same as they were in February of 2020. And a value of 110 means that prices were 10% above where they were in February of 2020. So we can see that in both Alaska and the U.S. as a whole, prices have risen across the economy by about 15% since the start of the pandemic. And generally speaking, Alaska's overall inflation has been tracking with national inflation relatively closely over this period.
Okay, next slide, please.
And I want to note that this is true whether we look at so-called headline inflation or so-called core inflation, which is shown on this next slide. Headline inflation measures the changes in prices and of goods and services of the entire economy, whereas core inflation removes the more volatile portions of prices, including food and energy prices. And so much like the last slide, we can see that core inflation in the United States and Alaska track relatively well with one another.
Okay, next slide.
We can also look separately at the two most volatile components of inflation, which are energy and food prices. So just like we've done in the last couple of slides, separate those out. And so here you can see that for energy prices, inflation in Alaska have been a little bit lower than in the U.S. economy as a whole, whereas food price inflation has been running a little bit higher than U.S. food price inflation. Although in the last couple of consumer price surveys, prices have come more into line with measures from the national economy.
Okay, the next slide.
So the last thing that we can do here in kind of decomposing inflation is separate core inflation into goods inflation versus core service inflation. The most important component of core service inflation is housing, and the most important component of core goods are durable and non-durable goods. So durable goods include like things like appliances and electronics, whereas non-durable goods are things like apparel or personal care items. Looking at core goods, we can see that between 2017 and 2021, prices are relatively flat, and then they start growing quicker than core service prices and remain elevated above core services until the last few months when prices have actually seen some deflation. And this is a story that I think tracks relatively well with folks' anecdotal experience. You know, during the first year of the pandemic, as people were at home a lot, they went out and they purchased a lot of these durable goods for their homes. They upgraded their televisions, made home renovations, these types of things. And so there was, you know, these shortages at the home goods store, and that led to inflation in that core goods sector. Now that people are returning to public entertainment venues, we're starting to see price pressure on that sector of the economy, core services, people returning to urban areas, which is putting price pressure on rental rates in urban areas of the U.S. economy. So,
okay, next slide, slide 25.
So I'm going to turn now to the state's workforce as characterized by the state's labor force participation rate. So the labor force participation rate is just a summary of the number of people that are in the labor force, either as employees or people that are looking for jobs, divided by the population. This figure shows that the state's labor force participation rate against other energy states, rural energy states like Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming, and then other energy states like Colorado, Kansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Utah, and then the national labor force participation rate. So we can see that Alaska's labor force participation rate is currently near or maybe even slightly above where it was pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, the labor force participation rate was about 65%, it's maybe just a touch higher today. Whereas the national labor force participation rate before the pandemic was just about 63%, and now it's just above 62%. And Dan mentioned, I think, a few reasons why the labor force participation rate nationally hasn't potentially recovered due to certain demographic trends. And so if we decompose this labor force participation rate by age group, for example, we could see that folks have kind of entered early retirement, so to speak. And that's one of the reasons why national labor force participation rate is not quite back to where it was pre-pandemic.
Okay, next slide, slide 26.
So this is just another representation of the data that we were looking at before, but indexed to February of 2020, which we did for some of those inflation slides. So we can see how things have changed since the beginning of the pandemic. So again, here, Alaska's labor force participation rate is slightly above where it was pre-pandemic. But for other energy states, their labor force participation rate is still lagging a little bit behind. So, you know, generally speaking, I think that this is a fairly positive comparison for Alaska versus the national economy and even some of these energy states with respect to some of these workforce issues.
Okay, next slide.
Another aspect of workforce issues is the degree to which lacking access to childcare impacts individuals and the labor force. So on this slide, I'm showing you a decomposition of the labor force participation rate by gender. So these are only available nationally, this decomposition. But we can see that the labor force participation rate for women is considerably below the rate for men. But if we go to the next slide, we can see how that rate is changing over time. So again, we're indexing this to this pre-pandemic level of February of 2020. And so we can see that the initial shock for women was a little bit larger than the initial COVID shock for men. And this is consistent with the idea that more women had to leave the labor force to participate in care work for family members. And we can see that women's labor force continued to lag behind that of men through about January of 2022, when this relative difference starts to close. And this gap has remained relatively narrow since then.
So is there a way ICER could help us track that for the state? One of the big policy issues we've been struggling with and working on is dealing with the workforce is childcare for families to help alleviate some of this workforce issues and family income issues. And I see here you've got some data that's nationally, but is it possible to help us with some state data?
Senator Stedman, I think that that's a great question, and it's certainly one that we can start to have a conversation about internally at ICER. And we've been trying to collaborate a little bit more with Dan Robinson and his shop on some of these data issues as well. One of the challenges in thinking about labor force participation is that you need to know not just the people that have jobs, but the people that are actively looking for jobs. And to do that often requires survey data. Surveys are expensive to administer and obviously suffer from some sampling issues, but are generally the best way to understand this group of people that we don't otherwise have visibility on. But it's certainly something that I think would be a worthwhile exercise to understand where the state's at with respect to this issue.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess if we only have national for now, how do we explain this closing in the gender gap of labor force participation? If, and I don't doubt it, initially that gap was about different understandings about who should be taking care of kids. Is it flexible work schedules? Did America suddenly get more enlightened about gender roles in the home? What do we understand about that closing gap?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I think that that's a great question. And understanding the mechanisms through which some of these things are operating, I think, is important. It's not something that I have any particular insight to. I think the two explanations that you had mentioned are both interesting and plausible. I wonder to the extent that childcare availability became a little bit more accessible as childcare centers reopened, as schools reopened over this period. I think that might have some impact on this closing gap as well. But I don't want to speculate beyond sort of what I've seen hard data for.
Okay, well, thank you. And then see if, when you have discussions, if ICER couldn't help the legislature with some data on dealing with child care issues, and so we better understand the challenges in front of us, and we'll have a opportunity hopefully to have a policy coming forward that is on point and helps with the issue, and we'll be working on it probably throughout next winter also or longer, who knows. So let's go on to slide 29.
So Alaska's economy, as many of you know, is often described as a three-legged stool, where roughly one-third of all economic activity, both direct and spillover economic activity, is attributable to the petroleum sector. One-third of all economic activity is related to federal spending, and one-third of all economic activity is kind of every other basic industry in the economy, which will include tourism, mining, fishing, air cargo, to name a few. I'd like to go through kind of each of these key catalyst industries in turn and talk about some potential upsides for them and potential downsides over the medium to long term. So on the next slide, we'll talk about petroleum industry first. And so, like I said, I'd like to think about this sector across three time periods, the short-term time period, the medium-term time period, and the long-term. And we can kind of think about these along the lines of the industry's production time frame. So in the short term, we've got wells that are drilled and pumping oil today. That determines the short-term output for this industry. In the medium term, we have projects that are in development. And then in the long term, we've got exploration and leasing activity that will potentially become future production down the road. So in the short term, the Department of Revenue is forecasting that oil prices are going to hold essentially in their current range between $75 and $85 per barrel, and that production is going to stay around 500,000 barrels per day. Of course, we all know that there's pretty considerable uncertainty around oil prices, but slightly less uncertainty around those production numbers. I think slightly more interesting is developments in the medium term. Obviously, there's been a lot of recent news around the Willow development, which at peak production would add 180,000 barrels of oil per day to the pipeline. It would involve significant drilling and expansion of production over the next 10 to 25 years. Likewise, with the Pika development, at peak production would add about 80,000 barrels of oil per day. Those are the two projects kind of with the most potential that are on the horizon, sort of kind of as far as the taillights are shining right now. And then third, we could consider indicators of what might be long-term activity, and that is leasing and exploration activity. I would characterize the results of the recent Cook Inlet and ANWR lease sales to be somewhat lackluster. But on the other hand, I think that there's, continued leasing and exploration activity in other areas of the North Slope. And then on the second point, I think that there's considerable uncertainty related to the speed and the scale of the so-called energy transition away from fossil fuels and what effect that might have on fossil fuel prices. Personally, I can say that I've been a little surprised at the speed of electric vehicle adoption, particularly in European countries. That's a trend that's likely to accelerate in the United States after the recent passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which offers pretty healthy tax credits for the electric vehicle sector. So I think that these are just potential trends to keep an eye on as we think about the long-term future of the industry in the state. And then finally, I want to make a point about capital discipline in the industry. This has certainly affected the industry in the last few years, and it may continue to be an important factor in the coming years. The notion of capital discipline is just this idea that there's pressure from shareholders to return free cash flows as opposed to pursuing growth-driven investment. And so if we've looked at the last couple of years compared to past price cycles, firms have been pretty reluctant to make large-scale investments. And so compared to past run-ups, we've seen, for example, less drilling activity, less of a ramp-up in oil and gas sector employment. And again, I think that this is driven by a desire from shareholders to chase cash flows as opposed to kind of a growth or an output-driven business model. This isn't unique to the oil and gas industry. I think we've seen kind of similar moves in the tech sector as VC firms have placed pressure on the firms that they've made investments in to kind of transition from this growth at all cost model to let's return some cash flows now. The reason that it's important to keep an eye on it is that it's obviously investments and drilling activity that generate the most job impacts from this particular industry. So if investments are going to decrease with respect to kind of overall industry health, I think that that's an important potential indicator to keep an eye on in the future.
Okay. And I think we're going to be asking for future updates on oil prices here in a couple of weeks from the committee members maybe a couple of weeks after the spring forecast because of changing trends. Next slide, please.
So on the next slide, we can consider what many think of as Alaska's second leg of its three-legged stool, which is federal spending. Obviously, the state's injections of funds from the CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan are winding down. But at the same time, there's new funding from the recently passed infrastructure bill and various pots of money from the Inflation Reduction Act that are just starting to wind up. As an example of this, I've pulled some numbers from the 2023 McKinley Capital Construction Forecast, which has estimated that private sector construction spending this year might be just under $3 billion, which would be about a $500 million increase over 2022's estimate. And then on the public sector side, about $2.5 billion in forecasted spending, which would be about a $300 million increase over last year's spending. And so this is kind of the first indicator of some of that infrastructure money starting to work its way into the Alaska economy. That spending is projected to ramp up over the next couple of years, and so that provides potentially a tailwind for the economy. And then I'd note, additionally, that kind of with renewed geopolitical heat in the Arctic region, thinking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Alaska might see increased military expenditures with increased attention toward the Arctic region. And that has, again, been a traditionally important source of federal spending in the state.
Okay, next slide.
And then for the third leg of Alaska's economic stool, thinking about kind of these all other industries category, the forecasts that I've seen look like tourism is going to be up over the next couple of years. I know that many people are forecasting a record visitor season this year for cruise ships, as people are excited to get back to visit the state. One of the other trends that I think it's important to keep an eye on for the state's tourism economy is the mode by which visitors are arriving. Over the last couple of years, due to the pandemic, we had much fewer visitors arrive by boat, but a lot more independent travelers. And those independent travelers tend to spend a little bit more money in the local economy. And so that visitor mode, I think, will be an important trend to keep an eye on in the future. With respect to the state's mining industry, our hard rock mining industry, ICER recently completed a study that sort of forecasted what mining industry activity might look like over the next 10 to 20 years, suggesting that the hard rock mining industry might remain relatively flat over the next decade or so unless something major occurs. Essentially, the state is going to swap out production from its existing mines with production from new mines, and the results might be kind of a net wash unless some other forces kind of intervene in the meantime. And then on the fishery side, we've seen, on the one hand, record runs over the last couple of years from Bristol Bay, one of the state's most important fisheries, but also in the last couple of years, important closures of federal fisheries, particularly crab fisheries. And I know that there's certainly debates over allocations that occur every year. And I know those debates will continue over allocations in the federal pollock and groundfish fisheries in the Bering and Aleutian Islands.
Okay. Next slide.
So this is the summary slide. And so, again, I'd just like to reiterate that Alaska continues to recover from the pandemic, but more slowly than most of the U.S. Important to note that I think our economy faces several headwinds. Again, as the Federal Reserve continues to fight national inflation, I think that there's some indications that the workforce challenges that I know have been a headache for many employers over the last couple of years might be showing some signs of easing, as we've seen rising rates of labor force participation. I didn't have any slides dedicated to it, but I know Dan covered this at some length. The state's demographic and out-migration issues will continue to remain a challenge in the medium to long term. And then thinking about our state's traditional economic engines, federal spending from the Infrastructure Act and Inflation Reductions Act, I think are probably a positive indicator. I think that there are some positive developments in our petroleum sector from recent announcements in Willow and Pika. But again, maybe some long-term headwinds in that industry. And then sort of from these other other sectors in our three-legged stool, you know, the tourism season points to a reasonably strong medium-term prospect. And then the last thing that I'd like to do on my last slide here is just point to some of the other great work that's being done by my colleagues at the Institute, including work on transportation costs in rural Alaska, the economics of preventative healthcare, workforce development issues, understanding the impacts of natural disasters and climate change, and issues related to rural infrastructure. Obviously, part of ICER's mission is to be a resource to you in the legislature in thinking about these issues. And so we're happy to make ourselves a resource as you are thinking through any of these or other issues that might be within our subject matter areas of expertise. And we'd obviously be happy to talk to you or your staff about the results of any of these projects. I'd like to thank you and the committee for your time today and your attention and questions.
Do we have any final questions? Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One issue that this committee has been dealing with over the last few years, and I think it's probably coming to a head, is rewriting the dividend formula. Last year, everyone is well aware, we had a $3,200 dividend, which expended north of $2 billion. That, from our viewpoint at this table, and I think on the third floor, is something that is non-sustainable. But you have not hit on that issue. And it is a topic that has received a lot of attention in this building as sort of the first step on a building block to come up with a fiscal plan for the state of Alaska. And I wonder if you might comment upon that.
Yeah, I would be happy to the chair. I would note that there are a few issues related to the economics of the state's dividend and the impact of the dividend on the state's economy more broadly. One of the things that Dan mentioned as he was wrapping up his talk was that economic uncertainty with respect to the state's fiscal situation creates uncertainty for our businesses as they think about making investment decisions in the state. Businesses want to invest where there's clarity about the rules and uncertainty about both the potential tax rates that they might face, but also the level of public services that they might expect for both themselves and their employees, I think is an important issue. That uncertainty just deters investment. And there was an ICER report that was written by my colleague, Hussein Ghatabi, a couple of years ago that attempted to quantify the effect of that uncertainty on the state's economy, you know, and it was to the tune of kind of millions of dollars of investment that was averted per year because of the lack of resolve to that issue. You'll probably also be familiar with the study that ICER conducted in 2016 that reviewed the economic impacts of various fiscal options that the state had available to it, one of which was decreases in the dividend amount, but also reviewed were, for example, increases in various broad-based taxes and decreases in state spending. As Dan mentioned, each of those has associated economic costs with it, trading off again, of course, against this issue of increased certainty about the state's fiscal situation. I'll note that, you know, we don't have any ongoing research right now about an update to that study. But it's something that I know that ICER has talked about internally, potentially doing an update to that 2016 report, because I know that it seemed to be quite valuable as the legislature was debating things over the last few years.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Watson, one of the things that, and maybe you mentioned it and I didn't catch it, but one of the big things that's kind of catching fire here is this carbon sequestration and capture issue that's the governor has proposed to us, and was wondering if you might be able to put a comment on that or give us some insight on what you see from your standpoint.
Yeah, happy to, Senator Olson, to the chair. So I think that there are two ways that I think about the carbon sequestration issue. One is the potential positive environmental benefits that it might have, and two are the potential impacts to the state budget. So with respect to issue one, I haven't seen kind of rigorous analysis about how much additional carbon savings might be achieved through a more robust state plan with respect to carbon sequestration. I think that those numbers would be interesting to look at, and I think my understanding is kind of the analysis is ongoing. But two, I think that even if the potential environmental benefits are small, the upsides for the state are potentially large. It may do no harm for the state to be engaged in these markets, even if it were to be the case that the environmental benefits turned out to be small. But again, I haven't reviewed that issue carefully, but I would be happy to kind of take a more thorough review of some of the analysis that's done once it's conducted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then one final note before we let you go. I see there you have some work being done on the natural disasters, and I'd just like to ask you to pass along when you guys do that work on the natural disasters on the potential repercussions from the federal government with constraints on building back buildings and developing our coastal communities. I have a hard time expecting that the federal government's going to step in with a check without putting a lot of strings attached, dealing with FEMA and the federal flood insurance. So if she could take that into account in that natural disaster analysis would be very helpful, because there is a concern, again, on what requirements they're going to be, and if they're going to put in building codes in communities that have no building codes, or what's the requirements and the repercussions throughout Alaska dealing with FEMA. With that,
I'd be happy to pass along the message.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Watson. With that, thank you and your colleagues for the work that you've done to help the Finance Committee and the legislature keep abreast of changing times. We'll take your information and use it hopefully wisely as we go forward, and we'll probably be asking for more assistance as we work through these policy discussions and matters here at the Finance Table. So thank you for
you for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you for your time. And Mr. Robinson also. It's both entities have been very helpful over the years to keep us on track dealing with policy. So that'll conclude the meeting today. And I'm a little surprised we're done a half hour early. I was worried in the beginning that we were not going to get done with this at all in the 2 hours and have to truncate it short. So I appreciate the brevity of the committee members and their questions when we get 50 slides on us to do in 2 hours. It's constraining. But our next meeting will be tomorrow at 9 a.m. It's tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. The committee will hear a proposal from the Department of Environmental Conservation for the state of Alaska to assume primacy. That's to assume primacy from the federal government on the Clean Water Act, Section 404 permits. And what that means in street language is wetland permitting, the cost and constraints of that. So we'll have that hearing tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We are adjourned at 10:32 a.m. We're adjourned.